Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. I wanted to have a slightly different show so that we can start off the new year right. My guest is a scholar, an author, a talk show host, and someone who can speak about the Constitution with knowledge and educate us. As I was speaking to the guest before we started the show, you know, New Year's resolution should be more than weight loss. It needs to be about how we protect ourselves, our rights, our liberties, and it's about becoming educated about our rights as American citizens. So we're going to speak with Mr. Paul Engel. He has more than 20 years studying and teaching about both the Bible and the U.S. Constitution. That experience helps him explain difficult concepts in a way most people can understand. And as one manager described, Paul can take the most complex idea and explain it in a way that my grandmother can understand. Freely admitting that he learned more about his Constitution from Schoolhouse Rock, more than in 12 years of school, he says that anyone can be a constitutional scholar. He can be heard daily at America Out Loud Network. He also has a study, and I think we will talk about that, the things that people can do to educate themselves. So let's get the ball rolling with thank you for coming on. Thank you for your time. And I think we should start from scratch. I don't know what's going on in our society, but I don't think children are learning civics anymore. And when people talk about the Constitution these days, it's almost as if it's a bad word that you're trying to stand up for your constitutional rights. Somehow that puts you at odds with a lot of entities in our society. So let's start off from the beginning. How did you get interested in this topic?
Well, thank you for having me on, Dr. George. It's interesting. I mentioned that I'm a product of public schools, mostly through the 1970s. So when it comes to the Constitution, I'm serious when I say I learned more from Saturday morning cartoons from Schoolhouse Rock than I did in 12 years of government-run education. I really didn't know. I really didn't care. And I was listening to a podcast, and I heard a quote from one of our founding fathers, our first Chief Justice of the United States, a gentleman by the name of John Jay. And he said, every member of the state ought diligently to read and study the Constitution of his country and teach the rising generation to be free. By knowing your rights, you'll sooner perceive when they are violated and be the better prepared to defend and assert them. And I realized I'd never actually read the Constitution. I kind of gave myself a challenge. I found a copy of it online, thinking it's going to be okay. You know, I read through the Bible every year. I've done for like 25 years. I'm thinking it's going to be a project like that. No, I sat and read it in under half an hour. And I was struck by two things. One, how much I had not been taught about what the Constitution says. And two, how much of what I had been taught is absolutely wrong. And that kind of got me down this road of, I want to learn more now. You know, I started studying the Constitution. I read the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers. I started looking for information about our founding fathers and what they wrote and quotes they made. And it sent me down this path where I became that guy. You know, I was the guy in a crowd, in a party that would correct people when they would make a misstatement about the Constitution. Try not to be obnoxious about it, but that's where I was. And then I was driving home one night. I was living in upstate New York at the time, and I was driving home from a Bible study at a friend's house, and I'm listening to a podcast, and they're talking about a report that was done in 2013 where they asked 1,000 people to, among other things, name the five freedoms protected by the First Amendment. And in that poll, 36% of respondents could not name a single freedom protected by the First Amendment. Not one. And that kind of got my dander up. I got, it's like, what's going on here? Why are we so almost universally constitutionally ignorant? And I thought to myself, gee, God, why don't we study the Bible the way my friends and I study? I'm sorry, why don't we study the Constitution the way my friends and I just studied the Bible? And that's where this idea for the Constitution study came from. Following John Jay's advice, reading it, studying it, teaching it, knowing our rights so that we are prepared to defend and assert them. And it's led me on an odyssey for the last few years where I've not only learned a tremendous amount, I've had the wonderful opportunity of speaking and teaching and being involved with helping other people to recognize not only what their rights are, but how they can defend them rather than simply being victims waiting for someone to come to their rescue.
That's wonderful. Knowledge is power. It's a mantra. And people need to start paying attention to that. But it takes effort and energy to do that. And, you know, we're hearing so many people talk about we're a democracy. And I'd like to clarify that, if you would. A democracy or a republic? What is the United States and what's the difference between the two?
Well, the United States is a republic. I know people like to call it a democracy. We've glorified this term democracy. We act like it's the magic cure-all. It's the utopia version of government. Even to the point now where modern dictionaries have redefined democracies to include republics. Now, what's the legal difference? The difference, main difference between democracy and a republic is, in a democracy, the people rule directly. The people legislate. The closest thing we see here is a state may have a referendum that they want to pass a law, but they can't get it through the legislature, so they decide they want to put it in the constitution of the state. So they draft this legislation, this proposal, they put it up for a vote of the people, and if enough people vote for it, it becomes the law. Now, that's different from a republic where we hire representatives to act in our name. So as a republic, the United States, the people elect representatives in the House to represent us. We elect people in the Senate to represent the states. And they exercise the power of legislation. They exercise the powers we delegate to them. And then we're responsible for keeping an eye over them. This is further restricted in this country because we are a constitutional republic, which means no matter what the people say to our representatives, we cannot order them to do something that's unconstitutional. Well, we can, but they're not expected to follow it. It's the idea of a soldier only has to follow lawful orders. You can't order a soldier, say, to murder somebody. It's an unlawful order. They don't have to follow it. It's the same thing. The interesting thing is actually how our founding fathers, what they thought of democracies. And, let's just say that they were none too fond of it. I haven't found a good example, a proof text yet. It's stated that Thomas Jefferson referred to a democracy as mob rule. My personal favorite is Benjamin Franklin, who described a democracy as two wolves and a lamb voting on what to have for dinner. They called it a liberty is a well-armed lamb contesting the vote. The main difference is in a democracy, your freedom, your rights are always in jeopardy from the republic, from the majority. You know, it's where we see it today, where people want to take away freedom of speech because they don't like what people are saying, or they want to take away your freedom of the press or your right to be secure from unreasonable searches and seizures, all in the false attempt to keep us safe. A republic is designed to work slowly so that concepts are evaluated over time before they're implemented. They're not rashly decided. And the constitutional limitations is designed to say there are certain things you just cannot do. Sadly, most Americans have a little, if any, understanding of this, even to the point of the Constitution requires the United States to make sure that each and every state has a Republican form of government. I think it was Madison was saying during the debates, we are creating a Republican form of government. But this branding of democracy has been repeated so often, people believe it. They've been told it so often, they simply assume it's true. The sad part is, at least according to Vladimir Lenin, democracy is essential to socialism as the way to get from where you are to socialism. So it is an important distinction.
Thank you for that. That really quite enlightening. So a bunch of questions come to mind for me. With it's supposed to be a representative government, how does it, is it kosher, so to speak, for the president to be able to sign executive orders and bypass our representatives?
Well, understand the purpose. We've had executive orders since George Washington. And all an executive order is, we make it sound big and important, it is an internal memo to the executive branch of the government. So remember, the president is the chief executive. He and he alone has a responsibility of the executive powers of the United States, Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution. But obviously, he can't do it alone. So he exercises that through the rest of the executive branch. And one way to do that is, here's an order. A perfect example would be Congress passes a law that to do something. It doesn't even matter what. So the president writes an executive order and says, okay, this department, this is how you're going to deal with this law. And this department, this is how you're going to deal with this law. It's internal. It is limited to the powers of the president, which it's used primarily to execute the laws of the United States. Now, part of the problem is the American people have elevated the president to a king. So they believe when the president signs an executive order, in fact, when the president just says, I'm going to sign an executive order requiring every company with 100 or more employees to mandate vaccines. It's unconstitutional. There's no law for him to do. There's nothing there. It's as empty and meaningless as if it never happened. But we've been trained to follow whatever he says. So you had companies actually instituting these mandates, not because he actually signed an not because it was legal, not because it was constitutional, or even because he signed an executive order. Biden just said in a press conference he was going to, and people started genuflecting to this person as if he is the king. When if you actually read some of the court cases in the 1800s, not only is the president not the king, he's not the most powerful man in the world, but these orders and even unconstitutional laws, they're empty, they're void. They are as if they were never passed. But we don't know that because we've not been taught the basics of civics. We've not been taught. I had a perfect example just last week. I did a radio episode. We were talking about the brouhaha on the border between Texas and Eagle Pass, where the Department of Homeland Security sent a letter where they claimed that, well, Congress passed a law and that's the supreme law of the land. It was just a problem. They actually quoted, they took a partial quote out of context to say exactly what it doesn't say. The Constitution says the laws made pursuant to the Constitution are the supreme law of the land. Congress makes a law that's not pursuant to the Constitution. It's void. It's empty. It's meaningless. And again, those aren't my words. Those are the words of Alexander Hamilton from Federalist Paper 78. Words of the Supreme Court from the Marbury versus Madison case, the Ex parte Siebold, Norton v. Shelby County. All of these state that unconstitutional acts are void. They're empty. They're meaningless. They are as if the legislation or the act never happened. But because we don't know this, we don't know that government is our employee. They're supposed to be public servants. They're supposed to work for us. We act as if they rule over us. And that's part of the education process that I'm trying to show people, is that, no, you're not a slave to whatever some bureaucrat or elected official comes up with. You establish the rules of government, the realm of government, its power, where its powers are. And we need to retake the reins of state, because we let go and have let governments run amok.
On that note, let's take our first break, because that was just a fantastic overview of how we've managed to seed our power. So let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Paul Engel, and you can go to his website, constitutionalstudy.com, and you can learn more about him and also, read articles that he writes, which are really timely. Now, you just described the federal government. I understand that the states' rights, it's quite powerful, right? So let's drill down to the state level. When the governors do the same thing as the president does in terms of writing executive orders, is there any change in that compared to what you just described when the federal government does it?
And if I could, one correct, the website is constitutionstudy.com. I don't want people to not be able to find me. But in many of the same ways, governors, well, they're just as human as anybody else. They can go far beyond their actual delegated powers. The interesting thing is, most people think about the three branches of government, and we talk about separation of powers between the legislative, executive, and judicial. We're not taught about the separation of powers between the federal, state, and local governments. So one thing we need to remember, the federal government didn't create the states. The states created the federal government. It's a very important point. It is the preamble of the Constitution says, we the people ordain and establish the Constitution. We did it through our states. When the original 13 states ratified the Constitution, they created the modern United States and the what we now call the federal government. Every one of the states that have joined since, all 37 of them, have said, we are joining a compact. We're joining an agreement, a union, that we tell the federal government what it can and cannot do. Only the states are authorized to actually change the Constitution. I know there's a lot of talk about a convention of states. Only the states can actually change the Constitution. Only the states can actually add to or remove power from the federal government. And the 10th Amendment is quite explicit. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. The Constitution was created by the states, they created the federal government. Now, that doesn't mean the states don't have their own problems. Each state is created by its own constitution. I live here in Tennessee. There's a constitution that created the state of Tennessee. It created the government of Tennessee, and it established its legitimate powers. The thing we forget is, if it's not delegated to the state, they don't have that power. Tennessee is one of about 35 or so states that actually state in the Constitution, all power is inherent in the people, that we delegate power to states to work for us. And it's this inverted understanding of the legitimate power structure. Power doesn't come from DC to your state capital, to your county seat, to you. It's exactly the opposite. We the people are the source of power. It's inherent from us. We receive it from our creator. And we create counties and cities and towns. And when we created states, and when we decided that those states wanted to work together, they created this union called the United States. You understand the proper order of power, the supremacy of who above whom. It drastically changes how you view, yes, what the president does and what Congress does and what the federal courts do, but also what your state does, what your state legislature does, even your county commissions. Understanding that and understanding the power you have to influence, especially at the local level, makes a tremendous difference in how you view what is going on and then how you react to it.
From what you said, this is even more intriguing because we've seen videos upon videos, for example, of people going to their legislative branch in their state and being arrested, being shut down. They can't speak because freedom of speech is, it's not honored. There's a lady who in Ohio who basically, I guess she told her sheriff off and she got arrested. I think she's able now to sue, and actually that got reversed. But by definition, how do we get to the point, do you think, that the government is just completely, it doesn't pay any attention to its people, which it's supposed to derive power from, which you eloquently just stated. How do we lose that?
Well, the thing to remember, at least at the federal level, most legislators are lawyers. They went to law school. I don't know what percentage of state legislators, I know it's not as high a percentage in the state, but it's still a significant number. And of course, you enter the legislature and you have lawyers telling you, well, you can do this and you can't do that. There's just one serious problem. They don't study the Constitution in law school. I've asked lawyers for almost 5 years now, every time I meet one, when you were in law school, did you study the Constitution or did you study constitutional law? I've had one person tell me they studied the Constitution. The rest study this thing we euphemistically call constitutional law, which is basically the opinion of judges. So we're basically playing a giant game of legal telephone, right? A judge reads something and he offers an opinion. By the way, the judges, the Supreme Court does not rule, they offer opinions. Most cases, most situations, judges don't rule, they offer opinions. But this person offers an opinion. And then someone else looks at that opinion and says, well, I'm going to read into this. And you end up with, you know, they don't study the Constitution. People in law school study the opinion of an opinion of an opinion of an opinion of an opinion of what someone thought the Constitution should say. So when you approach an attorney with an actual constitutional argument, they're flummoxed. They've never heard of such a thing because it isn't in the volumes of quote unquote case law that they've been taught. And I keep telling attorneys, I said, you should go back to your law school and demand a refund. How do you become an attorney in this country without studying the supreme law of the land? So part of that is legislators have been, well, they haven't been trained. Those who attend, and again, even those who aren't attorneys, I go to a county meeting, right? There's the county attorney, and the county attorney is basically saying what you can and cannot do, even when they're wrong, which makes for some interesting discussions on my end. But the biggest issue is the American people have simply turned over our government to the so-called experts. We forget that, no, we hire representatives. We don't elect them to rule over us. They're our employees. We hire them. And if they don't know the employee handbook, the Constitution of our states and the United States, then they're bad employees and we should fire them. But we don't think about it that way because we've been taught that they are our rulers, our leaders, not our servants and our employees.
It's incredible. So, you know, we're going to take a break in about 4 minutes, but I want to start the conversation with, you know, how do we go about, well, let's take another step back. In terms of lobbying, you just described the representatives as the, representing us as their constituents. From that standpoint, can a lobbyist be actually legal? Because they seem to follow that more than they do their constituents.
Well, a lobbyist is merely an individual or a company that's hired to promote the position of a group of people. Frequently, it's corporations. It's sometimes special interest groups. There's nothing wrong with them expressing their opinion through a third party. The problem is the legislators are more afraid of the lobbyists and the money that comes with them than they are the people they are supposed to represent, much less the fearing that they might violate their oath to support the Constitution and be held accountable for it. It's one of the reasons why, you know, we do have a say, but individually, we have very small influence. But believe it or not, that influence can grow if, you take enough small things and you create a big thing. It's one of the reasons why I encourage people to focus more on what's happening locally than what's happening in D.C.
I mean, from a Republican view of representative government, it still seems kind of shady to me that a small group can have that outsized power. There's millions of people in every state, but a small percentage has that degree of power. And usually it works against the people in the state and for the benefit of one entity, a corporation, a particular group. It hasn't gotten large. It seems like it's just become really overwhelming from a healthcare perspective. For example, the hospital corporations, big pharma, you name it, they have so much say in what the legislation is, and the doctor as an individual or as a group who are not part of those systems, they don't, and neither does the patient. So is it that this gotten really powerful and larger as time has gone on, or has it always been this huge infrastructure in the background?
This infrastructure has obviously grown, especially around healthcare. Once government got involved in healthcare, the bureaucracy blew up incredibly. But the root of the problem is that the people, they forget the power that they, or they haven't been taught the power that they have. They expect someone else to do this for them. They expect someone else to protect their rights. They expect someone else. You know, it's not my job to be involved with to tell my representative what to do. That's somebody else's job. I just show up every few years and vote. And it's that that abdication of responsibility that the American people have, that desire to find somebody else to deal with the problem, that has really driven the fact that representatives really don't care what the people think, because they know as long as they get the money from the lobbyists and the donor class, they could influence the people and they can still get elected. What's interesting to me is, while where we are is really bad, you can, this was warned. We were warned about this all the way back in by George Washington during his farewell address. I know we're coming up on a break, so I don't want to, maybe we can pick that up on the other side.
Well, let's do that. Let's take that break and come right back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Engel, and I'm sorry to have cut you off in that hard break, but I wanted to revisit what George Washington, what his statement was about, you know, the infrastructure that, to me, it's like a wedge or some sort of middleman between the people and the government that's supposed to represent them.
Well, it's interesting because, again, in 1796, as he was leaving the office of president, during his farewell address, he said, "The alternate domination of one faction over another, sharpened by the spirit of revenge, natural to party dissension, is its own frightful despotism." He says, "But this leads at length to a more formal and permanent despotism. The disorders and miseries which result gradually incline the minds of men to seek security and repose in the absolute power of an individual. And sooner or later, the chief of some prevailing faction, more able or more fortunate than his competitors, turns this disposition to the purposes of his own elevation on the ruins of public liberty." Now, again, Washington's talking specifically about political parties. But what you notice is the people start inclining their minds to seek, "Somebody save me." And that really is the important difference. See, the early in the Republic, the whole idea of individual, rugged individualism, pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, taking care of things for yourself first, and then seeking help when necessary, was commonplace. Now we've been trained to say, no, it's not my job to defend me. It's always somebody else's. It's not my job to keep my home safe. That's the police. It's not my job to make sure my house doesn't burn down. That's the fire department. It's not my job to make sure that my rights are defended. That's the courts or the attorneys or somebody else. We keep asking somebody else to decide to defend our rights, which means they're deciding what our rights are. We have, we're not going to agree on how things work and how things should work. We're always going to disagree. But when you turn over the decisions of your life to somebody else, then you literally become enslaved to their idea of justice. And where this turns into the question is, we've turned over one. We think as the American people, we think our sole responsibility, as I said, is to show up every 2 years and cast a ballot. And look at how many people focus on how many people cast ballots or what party did they vote for. But you know what you almost never hear? You never hear anybody ask this question, which, by the way, I ask of everybody that wants my vote. Show me when you did something to fulfill your oath to protect the Constitution and it cost you. Don't tell me your rhetoric. Don't give me another a political stump speech. When did you do something to fulfill your oath to support the Constitution? And show me when it wasn't simply, it's easy, everybody's doing it. No. You had to cut against the grain. You had to be different in order to do this. We don't expect that of our politicians. We expect our politicians to, first we expect them to lie to us, because we all know the answer, how can you tell when a politician's lying? Their lips are moving. But what does it say about the American people that we not only knowingly hire people that are lying to us, the ones that lie the best, we keep around the longest. We keep looking for someone else to defend our rights. We need to be looking at ourselves saying, okay, let me defend my rights right here under my household. And then how do I expand that exposure to others? To my town, my county, my state? And then eventually it percolates up to the United States. But as long as we're waiting for somebody else, if we just hire the right, the donkeys or the elephants, they'll fix everything. We put the right man in the White House and everything's going to get better. Nothing's going to get better, because that's the rough equivalent of putting a Band-Aid on a compound fracture with a staph infection. Right? You need to get to what's really going on. And when we start looking at that, people get discouraged because they think we can, we spent 150 years making this mess. They think we can fix it in a single election. It'll never happen. But we need to fix, we need what I think people should do. I say we need, this is my opinion, is we need to focus on fixing what we can. How I teach my family, making sure my daughter understands civics and the Constitution. I take the time to meet with my county sheriff. He's a chief law enforcement officer of the county. If there's somebody that's going to have my back, that's the most likely person. So I want to make sure that my sheriff is a constitutionally sound sheriff. He understands what I expect of him, and he understands what I will give back to him if he does his job. When I made the point when I first met him that, what I want is when someone picks up the phone in my house and dials 911, the deputy that shows up has been trained that their first duty is to protect the rights of everybody involved. If you do that, then how can I help? I can help teach a class. I can help write a position paper. I can stand with you at a press conference. I can speak in front of a committee somewhere. I've got your back. The American people keep saying, I want you to do all that great stuff for me, Sheriff. Absolutely. But I'm just going to sit back and enjoy it and not do anything for it. And that attitude of he's going to do it for me and all I have to do is vote for him every couple of years is part of why we're in this mess, at least in my opinion. And in my experience, once I learned where the real source of power is, it changed my life and my attitude about a lot of things forever.
Like one thing that you just described in being able to exert your power, you have to know what you're talking about. But does it also have to have, or should it? I mean, I know it has to have a specific tone to it, right? We're not just going out and just being confrontational, but it's having the facts. Does it matter where you exert that? I mean, you're talking about going to your sheriff. I get that. Most people may feel like they don't, in a big city, have access to that. So how would you recommend that people start that nucleus, that power, that way that we can interact with the powers that be? Because I think the tone has changed, don't you? Where they don't want questions to be asked. You are automatically they're on the defensive, and that puts people in harm's way more than not these days. So how can people have a better idea of how to communicate that will speak to those in power and not put them on the defensive? It's a kind of a broad question, but I'm just curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it is. And again, people are different and the people you're interacting with different. And I think part of it is to come, see, again, too often, you're right, we've got our dander up and we just go right on the attack. My point of view is whenever I'm dealing with any office holder is I ask them why they did what they did before I tell them what I think about it. I want to understand because maybe there's some information I don't have. It's part of it's the humility of saying I don't have the entire picture. Maybe there's something I missed there. But part of it is I've found as I've gotten more involved and more public notice, a lot of people come and they make assertions and they make claims that are founded in midair. There's no support for them. So one of the things we do here at the Constitution Study, I have a group called the Patriots. Our job, our goal, our mission is to help other people and other organizations better defend and assert their rights and have tools to do it. By the way, the Patriots is invitation only. The only way to get an invitation to the Patriots, you have to take a boot camp. It's a 1-hour online video boot camp, although I am going to be doing some of them live via Zoom later this year. But the very first thing we do deals with how do you make an argument and how do you evaluate other people's arguments? And we use 4 simple premises. The first is it's only an opinion until there's proof. I cannot tell you how many people want me to believe something is true because they say it's true and even get offended the fact that I asked for proof. So it's only an opinion until it's proof. An expert opinion is still only an opinion until they provide proof. We need evidence. We need arguments. We can't simply be, as Patrick Moynihan said, everyone's entitled to their own opinion. They're not entitled to their own facts. So we need to get to those details. Then it's whenever possible, original documents are bust. We want to go to the original sources. Or as I like to say, we want to hear it from the horse's mouth, not the other end. Because perfect example, right? If I talked about that DHS letter, if I listened to the DHS letter, I would believe that whatever Congress does is the supreme law of the land. I go to the original document, I see, oh, that's not exactly true. And then the fourth is check your facts. We have to be willing to realize we're human. We're going to be wrong in certain sense. So let's check our facts. Let's allow, you know, if you go to somebody to challenge something they've said, then you need to be willing to listen to them because they may challenge something you said and they may just be right. It's this idea of initiating a dialogue, not a rant. And that the biggest difference between that is if I'm basing a stand, if I, you know, for example, in here in Tennessee, the legislature is considering discontinuing taking federal education dollars, and I'm trying to get a chance to testify in front of that committee. Well, if I go in there and all I say is, well, it's my opinion it's wrong and it's my opinion it's bad, I've got, you know, it's my word versus somebody else's word. But if I walk up to that very same group and say, oh, by the way, yeah, it violates the 10th Amendment. It's a violation of Article 6, Clause 2. It's a violation of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. And here is the quotes. Here are the actual statements I'm showing you. Mm-hmm. I have the documents. It's one of the reasons why when I write my articles, every quote I can, there's a link that takes you to where I found that quote so that people can double check my work. That to me has much more influence. It doesn't always change people's minds. But it does have much more influence. And because it's grounded on something real, it's like the parable of the builders. You know, if you build the house of your argument on a rock, a foundation, something you can go to and stand and say, this says, the Constitution says this. It's a lot more able to stand when people challenge it and the storms rise and people, you know, say, no, you're wrong and all sorts of, it's a lot easier to stand when it's based on the rock. When if all you're doing is based on, well, so-and-so told me, they don't stand very well. And to me, that is the first step in how do you defend your rights? You learn how to both evaluate and to build arguments and debates that can stand on their own and don't crumble at the first sign of challenge.
I think that's very powerful. It's like building your hypothesis and then building all of the, doing your research and, you know, putting in the tenets that make this solid. I think that's the best way to put it. Mm-hmm. I have to do that in medicine as well. Now, from the standpoint of you've said your piece, you've cited your sources. What recourse do we have for those in power that totally ignore us? That you can't recall a senator, right? You can't recall a representative. I mean, from a people standpoint, I guess they can censure them in their system. But how much power do we have to get rid of these people aside from voting?
Well, the first thing we need to recognize is the offices of U.S. Senator and U.S. Representative, these are state level elections that appoint them. But part of it is we think that, like I said, we think our only action is to vote. I want to keep up. We spent 150 years making this mess. We're not going to fix it overnight. The best things you can do is, again, if you build a good argument, if you take it to them and you show them, hey, this is the problem here, or you should do this. I frequently encourage people to say, here's something we want you to do, and here's the constitutional reasons why you should do it. If they refuse to comply, and I always start with, well, you understand that if you're going to violate your oath, that means you're disqualified for office. My goal is to make sure everybody I can knows you're not qualified for office. It sounds unimportant until people start talking to their friends and neighbors and realizing, oh yeah, you know, to me, it's interesting when we describe things. For example, I use I talk about the state of Tennessee not taking education dollars. It's one thing to say it's unconstitutional for the federal government to be offering that money. But I also point out, you know, it's also, by the way, it's embezzlement. It's bribery. It's extortion. And that changes people's mindsets. So I think part of it is you build a good argument and you let them know the consequences of not doing their job. And they may look at you and say, yes, so what? You're just, you know, some podunk that's going to, you know, not vote for me. How do we spread the information to let other people know, again, not simply, I don't like this guy because the color of his hair or his bombast or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. No. Look at the damage he's done. Look at the crimes that are committed. Look at the fact that this woman has defiled the office they hold. Why would we want somebody? Wouldn't we? You're telling me this is the best person you could find for that office. And then we need to be willing to do the work, whether that means campaigning or talking with friends and family, or in some cases, looking to hold office. Maybe it's not a member of the House of Representatives. Maybe it's just sitting on a school board, but be willing to do something to change what we can, where we can, and then let that influence percolate through the rest of society.
I like that. So it's not overwhelming. It's something that's really that an individual could actually do. It gives you the sense of powerful, being powerful, not powerless. So let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Paul Engel. And how can people listen to your podcast?
Well, you can find my podcast on most of the podcast apps. It's The Constitution Study. You can also find links at my website, constitutionstudy.com. That's where most of my stuff starts. So I've got my articles. I collect news articles because I do a radio program. So I'm going through about 500-600 headlines a day, looking for content. And what I do is I take the interesting ones and I post them on the website as well. So you can see what's triggering my mind. You can also listen to me. I'm on 5 days a week, 4 p.m. Eastern time on America Out Loud.news, America Out Loud Talk Radio. So you've got that. You can find me. I'm also on YouTube, Rumble, Twitter. I'm not on Facebook. I'm not on LinkedIn. They booted me. They don't like me. But if you start at the website, you can find most of what's going on, most of the work that I'm doing. And I've also got, I have a spot there called Ask a Question. I'd love when people ask me questions because generally they're asking because either they don't know, or sometimes it's just something I haven't thought of a certain way. And it's a great place to get questions, you know, constitutionally based questions answered. I've got a mailing list they can sign up for as well. As I said, I've also got my Patriots program. It's up there. But there's, I do events. I come out and I speak. I do them online. I do them in person. There's a lot of ways. It all starts there. But one thing before we leave, there's a story I want people to consider, because we've talked about what do we do. It seems so big. How do we change this? How do we put up with all that? I want to tell a story of our sixth president, John Quincy Adams. Had an amazing life. At the age of 8, he was doing musket drills with the Massachusetts militia. At the age of 12, the country sent him to France to be his father's secretary in the court of France. At 14, they sent him to Russia because the ambassador to Russia didn't speak Russian or French, and John Quincy spoke French. So imagine, at the age of 14, he's now spent 4 years now as a foreign diplomat for his country. He became our sixth president. And then, by the way, he served every administration from Washington up until his own, I believe. And after serving as president, he gets elected to the House of Representatives. And his key focus is abolishing the slave trade. That's all he wants to do, is abolish the slave trade. For 17 years, he tried to pass a law to abolish the slave trade. The problem was the majority of the House of Representatives was pro-slavery. Didn't matter. 17 years, he kept plugging away. He's offering resolutions. He's submitting legislation. At one point, the House actually passed a rule they nicknamed the John Quincy Adams gag order just to shut him up, and they couldn't. 17 years, he's an old man. In fact, I believe he actually died on the floor of the House of Representatives. So he's getting to the end of his life, and somebody asked him, Mr. Adams, you've been doing this for so long. You haven't won once. You've lost each and every time. Why do you keep doing this? And his answer was as poignant as it was simple. Duty is ours. Results are God's. See, I think too often the American people, we only look to the result. If we don't get the result we want, we think we're a failure. Sometimes doing what is right because it is right is its own success. And maybe you win and maybe you don't, but you do what's right because it's right. Because you're not looking at the short-term solution. You're looking at the long-term gain. Because near the end of his life, John Quincy Adams took a young member of the House as a protege to help him get started and get going, to see what it was like from an old member of the House. This gentleman, by the way, his name was Abraham Lincoln. After 17 years of trying to get rid of the slave trade, after failing to the point where he died on the floor, apparently a failure, but his protege was the man that signed the Emancipation Proclamation, the 13th Amendment, the man that the president, I should say, he didn't do it alone, but the president that actually ended legal slavery in this nation. What would he have done so if he had not fallen under the wing of a man who was willing to fight the good fight, whether he won or lost? I think that attitude will make a tremendous change in the future of this country.
Man, that was really powerful and empowering as well. I mean, now I feel much more confident about what I can do. It's really up to the individual to make every choice with intention towards expanding our rights and our freedoms and not having them taken away in any sense. And would it be reasonable to think about it in terms of, and it seems to me the government, the largesse of the government, every time they give you money, it is never without a string attached. It reminds me of the Affordable Care Act. The states that signed on were given this carrot of Medicaid money, but it came with a really big attachment to it because it wasn't going to be forever. It was going to be pulled away at some point, yet they would have all these people on their rolls and they wouldn't be able to afford it. And we're seeing it here in Georgia where they lowered or expanded, made it harder for people to be eligible. And there's a lot of people now who've been removed from the Medicaid rolls. So would part of our power be telling our states to stop taking money from the federal government? I mean, is that something that would change the direction a bit?
Absolutely. Alexis de Tocqueville, when he came to the United States to see why we were being so successful, he said, "This nation, the United States, will continue until Congress realizes it can bribe the public with their own money." Congress has learned that lesson well, because every dollar from D.C. was taken from the pocket of an American. Every dollar that they spend, that they allegedly give to you, was taken from you in the first place. And you're right; they all come with strings. By the way, it's also the most expensive way of doing things. That's probably a statement for another day. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing we need to remember is there's no such thing as a free lunch. There's no such thing as free healthcare. There's no such thing as free education. There is no such thing as a free lunch. Somebody pays the bills. Now, the question is, he who pays the piper calls the tune. Do you want to be, when you look at your own healthcare, do you want to be the one that's making that decision, or do you want some bureaucrat in D.C. making that decision for you? Do you want to be making the one deciding what's taught in your schools, or do you want somebody in Atlanta deciding what's taught in the schools? Somebody completely detached from your own school district that has no consequence if they get it wrong. But I think the biggest thing is, and I come back to this frequently, we don't have to eat the whole elephant. We do it one bite at a time. And the reason I do this, as I mentioned, I have a daughter. Now, my daughter is not inheriting a nation as free as the one I inherited from my parents. But all I can do is make it as free as possible so that she and then her children and her children after that can live as free as I can make it possible for them till I pass that torch on to them. I don't want them cursing me because I couldn't be bothered to do the right thing because I didn't think I was going to win. Or I was more concerned about donkeys and elephants. Or I just saw the size and scope of the problem and refused to do anything. To me, that's giving up. And our children and our children's children are going to suffer the consequences of that. And I believe they're going to curse us when they realize we could have fixed this if we had started earlier. And now they're dealing with the consequences, the same way we are from our parents and our grandparents.
I think that's an excellent idea right there. I mean, from the standpoint of all of these government programs, Social Security, it's just a disaster now. We have the Medicare program, all these things that I think they had good intention, maybe, but in practice, they've just sucked the life out of every individual and the economy, you name it, and it's not working. So I'm a big fan of personal responsibility like you are. And you really want to look your child in the eye and say, I really did everything that I possibly could. And I want to revisit one last thing that you said initially about mandates. They're not the law, correct?
No, well, the mandates are illegal. They are a deprivation of liberty and property without due process of law, which makes them violations of the Fifth and 14th Amendment. And that actually is one of the things that got me started was an event I was at just after the county established a mask mandate. And I was the only one there that was prepared. I had prepared a defense should the police come up and try to force us to wear masks. I had the law on my side. I had the proof of that on my side. And I was willing to stand up and say, no, you cannot do that. You're the one actually committing the crime at this point. And maybe I would have stood alone, probably would have stood alone. And maybe I would have gone to jail at the time. But I had prepared. And that preparation, proper preparation, prevents poor performance. It also can save your rights if you're willing to stand for them.
I think that's a great place to stop, that call to action. In the minute that we have left, again, how can people read your blog, listen to your podcasts?
So again, best place to start is the website, constitutionstudy.com. You can always sign up there for notifications. I am on YouTube and Rumble. Once a week, I've got a video going out. Go to americaoutloud.news, and you can listen to the broadcast either live, 4 p.m. Eastern time, or you can catch the podcast on your favorite podcast app. And again, if you have a question or you need some assistance with something, just go to the website, click Ask a Question. I'll do my best to answer it.
Mr. Engel, I really love having you on. It's just such a breath of fresh air. And I would say I'm really stoked to make sure that my rights aren't taken away in any sense. And everybody I can educate, I'm happy to do it.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a lovely time.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.